I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today's guests are on the front lines of making cities sustainable with their work on housing, mixed-use development, and commercial main streets. Jonathan Rose has been called the father of the green affordable housing movement. His projects in the South Bronx and in Harlem are showing how green buildings ought to be for everyone. Brian Goodman is renewing Boston's neighborhood commercial districts through its Main Street program, demonstrating that old does not necessarily mean disposable. We'll talk to Jonathan Rose and Brian Goodman today on Smart City, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Jonathan Rose has been called the father of the green affordable housing movement. The national real estate firm he founded, Jonathan Rose Companies, collaborates with cities, towns, and nonprofits nationwide to develop projects that are both green and socially responsible. Its mission is to repair the fabric of communities. His planning and development work has received awards from the Urban Land Institute, American Institute of Architects, National Resources Defense Council, and Global Green. His projects include affordable housing and mixed-use developments in the South Bronx and in Harlem, as well as in downtown Denver. Jonathan is a frequent speaker and writer on the subjects of smart growth, affordable housing, and the green building movement, and he was profiled in E2, a recent PBS series on environmental design and energy conservation, narrated by Brad Pitt. The mission of your company is to repair the fabric of cities while preserving the land around them. What is your approach to repairing the fabric of cities?
Well, first we have to understand what cities are. And cities are complex networks, overlapping networks. This is actually one of the things that makes cities really, really great. So there are physical infrastructure networks, such as public transit, water, sewer, etc. There are social, educational networks, such as school systems, museums, libraries, performing arts centers, housing networks, economic networks, cultural networks, all those. You get all this aggregating in cities. And so we look for the places of highest leverage where one can, which is typically where these things tend to intersect, where one can really make a difference in a city.
As a multidisciplinary planning, project management, development, acquisitions, and asset management firm, how do you get yourself connected to those, to those places where the systems or the networks intersect? In other words, you mentioned such a range of networks at work, if you will, in cities. And so, how do you find your way to those points of intersection, which indeed have the highest leverage?
Great. So we work in four ways. The first one is as planners, and we work with cities primarily on creating climate change strategies. I mean, 770 cities have now signed ICLEI's pledge to reduce their climate impact dramatically, and some cities like Chicago and New York have very progressive plans. Many other cities have wonderful aspirations, but they haven't really figured out how to get there. So we've put together a team working with some extraordinary not-for-profits such as Enterprise Community Partners, the Trust for Public Land, the Center for American Progress, NRDC, and others. And we're actually working with cities, proposing to work with cities to help them create real implementable strategies such as preserving parkland, creating new parks, planting trees, reducing their energy, increasing renewable energy supply, recycling, things, building green, affordable housing. Very practical but visionary ideas. The second thing we do is we actually help cities and not-for-profits manage projects like the greening of school systems, the greening of municipal buildings. We've been building green, mixed-use, mixed-income demonstration projects, developments that are always next to walkable communities or next to transit, to show that this better model of development actually can be financed, can make money, that the market accepts it, and it's the right thing to do. And finally, we have a green real estate investment fund because we believe so much in cities, and we know that they perform much better economically as real estate investment locations than the suburbs. And so we're taking advantage of it, actually, through our fund.
You mentioned that when you build demonstration projects, you always build them near transit. And yet many cities, many of those 770 cities that have signed the climate change agreement, really have no transit. So how do you think about retrofitting or working in communities in green ways that really do not have transit?
So there are, first of all, we often spend more energy getting to and from buildings than the buildings themselves. So there are several solutions. Number one is we need a national infrastructure policy, which we don't have, and at this moment our government is planning on doing a stimulus package, which frankly is only going to enhance consumerism for another quarter or two rather than really do a long-term investment in building transit systems around America, which people want, which actually creates jobs, creates long-term sustainable jobs, would be the right thing to do for an economic stimulus. But not all transit has to be subways and light rail. Transit can also be buses. Most people don't like buses because buses are ugly and hard to get into, but there's a lot of European models that are very, very attractive. And the other thing we really believe in is just simply higher density and mixes of uses that allow people to walk more. So many Americans now work in a place where they have to drive to lunch, drive to take the kids to daycare, drive to do this, drive to do that. The more you can concentrate those uses around an old town center, you revitalize the town center, and every time you can substitute a driving trip for a walking trip, you have made the climate a better place.
Let me ask you, Jonathan, going back to the mission of your company to repair the fabric of cities, is the need for repair inevitable, or is it the result of our past development practices?
First of all, we live in a world that in which things are always wearing down. We're always building new, and things are always wearing down, and so it is inevitable. It's the nature of the universe. Impermanence is the nature of the universe. And so, yes, we are always going to need to repair our places, and we need to invest in them. But in fact, there was a concerted policy after World War II to draw development into the suburbs, to fund infrastructure in the suburbs, that was not helpful to cities. And we today still have federal policies that are very unhelpful to cities. For example, much housing in America is built with federal credit enhancement, basically a loan guarantee subsidy. And the limits, the goal was to fund more affordable housing. Cities are more expensive places to build. And many of these, for example, you cannot use these credit programs in New York City because the simple cost of construction is too high. So there's been a bias in many federal programs towards suburban sprawl. That happens to be cheap places to construct, but expensive places for society in the long run to support.
Are we at a point today where developers, landowners, urban leaders get that, or do we still have a lot of education to do?
We are in a transition point where we have a lot of education to do, but also where developers and landowners do get it. I am actually just coming from a trustee meeting of the Urban Land Institute, which is really the National Association of Developers and Planners, an extraordinary organization with 39,000 members. And the Urban Land Institute's policy is now deeply committed towards a national policy to make the right infrastructure investments, smart growth, and really understanding that climate change and land use are intimately linked.
You write that you develop projects that are both green and socially responsible. Tell me, what is a socially responsible project?
We believe that a socially responsible project is one that serves all people. Now, not every project can serve all people, but we actually believe that as a national development policy, we need to be thinking about serving all people, and this means people of lowest incomes, moderate incomes, middle incomes, and the upper ends of the market. And too often, development policy only focuses on one of those sectors. So, for example, we're proposing a project now in downtown Albuquerque that will literally have housing that ranges from homeless to market rate. We are just completing a project in Harlem that will have housing for youth aging out of foster care. 40% of the kids in Harlem who are in the foster care system go homeless the day they turn 18 because there's no support structure for them. Again, because we believe in diversity, about a third of those units will go to the kids, and then two-thirds will go to serve local families needing affordable housing.
To what extent, in your experience, can you get market rate and above home ownership in locations that are also serving homeless people or foster care kids coming out of foster care?
So these are rental projects, not home ownership projects. Although we have seen through the Hope 6 program, which has been a wonderful program that prospered particularly in the 1990s, to revitalize public housing, that we have seen that mixed income home ownership in cities really, really does work. What we see it more prevalently is in rental projects. One of the most popular mechanisms for financing rental apartment buildings in New York City is called the 80-20 program, in which 80% of the units are market rate and 20% are affordable. And you will have apartments renting to people earning $200,000 and $300,000 a year, living next to people earning $17,000 and $19,000 a year, and they all do just fine together, and those apartments do not suffer from a unit of vacancy or a penny of rent loss because they're 80-20.
And the 80-20 is a requirement of local government?
Well, they're two separate things. The 80-20 happens to be a federal program that provides tax-exempt and therefore lower finance bonds along with low-income housing tax credits. So basically a financing mechanism that makes it in certain markets more profitable, actually, to build a building that's 20% affordable than one that's not. It's a wonderful incentive program. It really creates the kind of mixed-income communities we believe in. Then some communities, more and more we're seeing, are doing something called inclusionary zoning. Inclusionary zoning is a wonderful program in which a city will increase the density of a neighborhood, something developers always like, but in exchange for the increased density, require the developers to provide a proportion of the additional housing as affordable housing. In effect, the cost of the affordable housing is being subsidized by the higher density, and you're getting all the environmental benefits of density and the social benefits of mixed income.
But isn't there a paradox there? Because what we really want is to encourage density.
Yes, so it's a good thing.
Well, it's a good thing, except that we really should be requiring the density. I mean, in other words, you really shouldn't have to do anything special to get the density, because that's actually what we want, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But I guess what we're saying is that when we do increase density, which is the right thing, if we can design a program that simultaneously rewards the developer, encourages density, but also creates mixes of incomes, that's really the best for a city. I mean, if you think about it, cities need investment bankers to survive, but they also need people who clean their offices, and we need school teachers.
Sure.
And firemen. We need housing for all. And so a socially responsible housing program, we believe, is actually designed to accommodate that full range of diversity in the city.
Yeah. It just seems that perhaps we should require affordable housing in projects that are low density, because there needs to be some stick, if you will, associated with doing things that long-term are not particularly good for communities or good for the environment. Let me ask you about some of the principles that guide your practice. I think they are quite interesting. You've talked about this strong belief you have in impermanence. When you think about that as a guiding principle, how do you plan and develop for impermanence?
Well, the first thing is actually just to understand that it exists. We have two principles that are really like gravity. There's impermanence, that things change, or it's really just the nature of the universe, and the other one is interdependence, that things are interconnected. So part of it is just recognizing, when one recognizes the basic laws of physics and biology that organize the universe, it makes it a whole lot easier to do great projects. So when we recognize things change, one of the most exciting parts about it is realizing that if things are bad, you can make them better. So it actually gives us the freedom to dream and think of how we can improve the places that we work in. But we also recognize that buildings wear out and you have to provide proper budgets for their future renovation. We understand that green technologies are always getting better and we want to leave room to accommodate that. So, for example, let's say solar is too expensive right now. We know the cost of solar is going to come down, so we can make buildings solar ready for the future. So we really design with the future in mind.
I'm intrigued by your concept of livelihood. You call for a new economic development paradigm that focuses on livelihood rather than jobs. How can planning, design, and development support livelihood?
So livelihood is really understanding not only, so by the way, I think jobs are extremely important. I'm going to talk about that in a second. But it's jobs that are really integrated into people's lives. And one of the interesting things about the green revolution that is coming is that the Wall Street totally gets it. So Goldman Sachs has got a hold in General Electric and everybody else has a full green initiative. We need to make sure that initiative reaches all sectors of society. There's a wonderful movement called Green Jobs for All. For example, take New York City. New York City has 850,000 buildings. If we're going to green them, the most cost-effective way to do that is to insulate them. What a wonderful opportunity to create small business opportunities, jobs for low-income people, for lesser-educated people. We can connect the green movement, which has frankly been seen as a white elitist, more educated movement. If we can connect that with the green jobs movement, we can do a whole lot for our economy and for the residents of our cities. I've been very engaged in this movement, and interestingly, the people who are the activists for green jobs, when you ask them what do we need, in addition to job training and curriculum and employment, they say, we need parks and gardens. We need to be able to take our kids on overnight camping trips so they have contact with nature, etc. So you begin to see how the greening of a livelihood is not just about the job, it's about the whole way that, the healthy, engaged way that somebody can live.
As you point out, New York has a lot of buildings that need to be insulated, and that could represent a lot of jobs. Is there any real movement toward connecting those two things together and financing it in a way that it can be paid for with the energy savings that result?
That's an excellent question. This is so new. It is just emerging. There is a wonderful national not-for-profit organization called Enterprise Community Partners, which is working on this. And I think you're going to begin to see models for how to finance it very shortly, because insulation pays back in just a couple of years. So it is very easy to finance out of savings. The question is, how can we aggregate lots of little transactions, make a larger one enough, big enough to really appeal to the financial markets? But I think that is emerging.
You write, the shape of our communities shapes our lives. Explain what you mean.
Think of the old New England town square. The town square itself stood for the commons, and typically around it were four buildings: a courthouse, which represented justice; a town hall, which represented governance; a library or school, which represented knowledge; a church, which represented spirit. The very going to the center of that town informed you of the values of that community. And you also would go to the courthouse or the townhouse, the town hall, so you would interact with those value systems. So the place spoke of who we were and reflected who we were. Today, if you go to our town centers, primarily what you see is retail, because we are primarily a consumerist, materialist community, the culture. And so that's what's reflected in our places. If we bring back the places that speak of other values to our communities, it gives us more of a chance to participate in those other values, and it's a mutually reinforcing thing.
And what would be the expression today of those other values, Jonathan? What would you put in the town square today? I mean, most of Americans are unchurched. Whether that's a good or bad thing, I'll leave it to others to decide. But so the church doesn't quite represent what it once did. The library doesn't represent what it once did. What would be those new institutions?
Well, I disagree. I think libraries are amazing places. And we're seeing, by the way, a whole new library movement by the way, Chicago about 10 years ago built a great new library. San Francisco has built a great new library. Seattle. And we're seeing when these new libraries are built or libraries are renovated, dramatic increase in use. Librarians who have access to the Internet, who can reference librarians, are tremendous, helping small businesses grow. They're gateways to knowledge. Interestingly, we're hearing about some libraries now in downtowns that after midnight run English as second language classes for immigrant workers. So partly we have to reimagine what these institutions are. Performing arts centers that used to traditionally only perform classical music are now performing a much more diverse range of culture, engaging people. Educational institutions, we are seeing in the 60s, 70s, 80s, there was a big movement to move community colleges to large tracts of land in the suburban areas. We're now seeing the bringing of community colleges back to downtowns. For example, Gateway Community College is coming to the downtown of New Haven, bringing jobs and an aspiration for knowledge, a chance to move ahead for people back to their downtowns. These are the kind of value institutions that represent the values I think that will help us in our future.
What should mayors and urban leaders be requiring of developers that they are not requiring today?
Number one is green building standards. I mentioned Enterprise Community Partners earlier. They have written a wonderful green standard for multifamily housing called the Enterprise Green Community Guidelines for commercial buildings. The LEED system makes a whole lot of sense. So there's a lot you can ask of developers to make greener buildings, and as I mentioned earlier, to make mixed-income buildings. But developers also have a right to ask something of their communities, and that is an investment in parks and open space and walkable communities and recapturing riverfronts and old rail lines, et cetera, making walking trails and a commitment to mass transit that supports that. You know, you need density to have transit. You have enough people riding the transit, and you need transit to support density. They're mutually interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that developers actually hate, believe it or not, is building parking, because you waste a whole lot of money and take up a whole lot of land parking cars, and you don't make very much money on it. So if you have more transit, like in New York City, you don't need parking at all to build a luxury building. So if we had more transit and more density, the developers could actually spend less money on parking, and they'd actually like that.
Where does that conversation take place? How does it take place?
Well, that's a really important question, because the conversation is not taking place. And if we go to the national scale, America is going to grow by over 90 million people in the next 30 years. And we have no clue how we're going to manage it. If you look at it, the markets currently are driving that growth to places like Atlanta and Phoenix, which are running out of water and which require air conditioning. I'm not against growth in any particular part of the country, but I do believe we really need to have a coherent conversation about how to manage our growth. That has to take place at the neighborhood level, at the community and city level, most importantly at the regional level, at the state level, and I also think we need a national conversation. And the reason for a national one is that we need to rethink how we allocate national resources to incentivize the right kind of growth.
Jonathan Rose is the founder of Jonathan Rose Companies, a national real estate firm that collaborates with cities, towns, and nonprofits nationwide to develop green and socially responsible projects. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planetta's and assistant editor, Nate Berg.
London Mayor Ken Livingstone has just announced a nearly $1 billion plan to make the city one of the world's best places to ride a bike. He's announced plans to create a superhighway system dedicated solely to bicycles, consisting of 12 routes throughout the city. According to an article from The Guardian, Livingstone is calling this the biggest investment in cycling in the history of the city. The Cycle Superhighway is expected to be built over the course of about 10 years and will eventually connect many of the outlying suburban town centers to the heart of London. The system is also planned in conjunction with a bike rental program similar to one set up this past year in Paris. More specific plans are expected to be released in coming weeks, but this ambitious proposal is already being looked at as an example for other world cities to follow. And in Washington, D.C., the possibility that federal funding may be denied for a rail link between the city and Dulles International Airport has dashed the hopes of many transit advocates. But some couldn't be happier. According to an article in the Washington Post, advocates of bus rapid transit have jumped on the funding denial as an opportunity to push for reconsideration of BRT for the transit route. BRT had previously been thrown out as an option based on the belief that it would be too difficult to acquire the right-of-way for dedicated bus lanes, and that a rail line would attract more riders. But now that the Federal Transit Administration is on the verge of denying the rail option nearly $1 billion in federal funding, the much cheaper option of bus rapid transit is coming back to the surface as maybe not such a bad idea. And finally, politicians in Georgia have proposed legislation that aims to move the state's border about a mile north into neighboring Tennessee, a land annexation they say is backed up by an unenforced border survey from the year 1818. But this effort is not just being made for the sake of historical accuracy. By moving the border to what Georgia lawmakers say is its rightful place along the 35th parallel, a portion of the Tennessee River will legally fall within the borders of Georgia, allowing the drought-stricken state a new source of water. The Tennessean reports that even though officials in Georgia unanimously approve the annexation plan, they'll also need approval from the state legislatures in Tennessee and the U.S. Congress before the rebordering can occur. Lawmakers in Tennessee are saying there is simply no chance of that happening. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. After a short break, we'll find out about Boston's Main Street program. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Brian Goodman is business manager at Boston Main Streets, a program with the City of Boston. He manages Main Street's Wi-Fi and Boston Community Change. He's been a Peace Corps volunteer in Bulgaria, an entrepreneur, and an MBA student at Babson College. Tell me, Brian, how does a Main Street program work in a city the size of Boston? I typically associate Main Street programs with smaller communities.
Sure. Well, Boston Main Street was brought to the City of Boston by Mayor Thomas Menino about 11 years ago as the first pilot urban Main Street program. And as you said, traditionally they're in neighborhoods, but Boston Main Street was set up where each of the neighborhoods of Boston was like a rural town. So we have 19 neighborhoods, Main Street neighborhoods in our program, as opposed to some of the other Main Street programs, which are standalone programs in a single community. And then each of those 19 programs are set up as nonprofits, separate 501c3s, with their own boards and their own executive directors. And we have a staff here downtown that provides kind of umbrella support and functional support for each of those 19 programs. And we also do program-wide initiatives that apply to each of the neighborhoods here in Boston.
And do the Main Street programs primarily do clean, safe, attractive kinds of programs or something more?
Well, the way that the Main Street program is structured is around four kind of general principles. Design, which is about designing kind of the storefronts, the look and feel, the streets, open spaces. So we provide matching grants and work with store owners and landowners. The other is organization, where we actually work to organize the community at large as a community to start thinking about the needs of the community collectively. Promotion is the third. Promotion pretty much deals with promoting the community as its own entity. So, for instance, Hyde Jackson is considered the Latin Quarter, giving that community a sense of a brand and a place and then promoting it to the larger city and the individuals to get them to come in and to visit and spend time in our neighborhoods and our shops. And then the third, or the fourth, I should say, is economic restructuring, and that's where they actually work to provide kind of capacity building for the business to understand what kind of leakage issues are in the community and what can be done to actually strengthen kind of the local economy itself. So those are the basic four principles that the program is designed on. In addition to that, there are, as I said, program-wide initiatives that we run here from downtown. We do clean street type programs where we actually get volunteers to come out and clean the streets around the city. We do that in partnership with the city. And then we do things like Boston Community Change, which is a program we've launched here to actually provide a tool for what we call generating regenerative commerce or keeping dollars within a local community. We've launched a wireless program where we are trying to create wireless hotspots within the community itself. So we'll, you know, in addition to each of those 4 points in each community, we also look for ways to kind of weave the fabric or the thread together within the communities and across the communities, and looking for ways to cross promote the neighborhoods of Boston as well.
I'm interested in the identity, the promotion that you do of these neighborhoods, or they do, of these neighborhoods as their own entity. Neighborhoods change over time, and a neighborhood that may be identified with, let's say, a particular ethnic group, that ethnic group may change over time. And I'm curious, have you run into any change issues yet, evolution issues, where the neighborhood reality is no longer quite fits the neighborhood image?
Mm-hmm. Neighborhoods do go through change. It is true. I think a big part of what Main Street is trying to do is to preserve some of the look and feel and that kind of ethnic makeup of a given neighborhood. So we are open to change and we encourage change, but there's a certain amount of it that we're actually trying to strengthen those Latin districts, or strengthen the Cape Verdean communities in Upham's Corner, or strengthen the Vietnamese communities in Fields Corner. We do see change happening in the communities, particularly now, you know, as the city becomes a more popular place to live and work and people are looking for a shorter commute. It does create what I would say is an opportunity for a program like Main Street to look for ways to build bridges between the different ethnic groups within communities as they develop. So a good example is Washington Gateway. Washington Street down near the south end has seen a lot of development in recent years, and the program there has done an excellent job of working with developers to encourage mixed-use space that allows for mixed incomes in the community, as well as kind of mixed kind of ethnic demographics within the community. And I think that goes a long ways if you can actually maintain the existing ethnic community and then build opportunities for them to interact with each other. I think it breaks down some of the barriers that traditionally people feel as new ethnic communities move in, or other ethnic communities feel like they're being forced out. A lot of times it's just other things that they can be doing together, other ways for us to encourage them to work together as an organized community, as opposed to seeing themselves as silos within the community.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about the leakage issues. Obviously, economies today are regional. They're at least at a metro scale. People move between different suburbs, different incorporated towns to jobs in other towns, and then move back again for each night to their homes. I'm curious about this notion of leakage at a neighborhood scale, because in fact that's exactly what we expect to happen today. That's how economies work, because economies are metro, they're not neighborhood. How do you think about a neighborhood economy, and what in fact is leakage, or more importantly, what in fact should be captured locally?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Boston actually is unique among a lot of other cities, because maybe more so than some other metro areas, it really is a city of neighborhoods. So while I agree, I think there is a certain amount of leakage that happens in a metro area, I think Boston is unique in the sense that some of our neighborhoods do really feel like communities. So when I think about leakage, I think about people leaving the neighborhoods and having to travel outside of the city to get on Route 1 or Route 93, have to head to, you know, some larger shopping malls, to get the basic types of things that would be better if they could get local food, local produce, local locations for things like getting your hair cut, local boutique shops, local retail. A lot of those types of businesses provide opportunities for people to meet and interact within a neighborhood setting, which does more than just drive local business. It also drives interaction between constituents in the community, breaks down barriers of awareness, which I think are oftentimes very popular in cities, this sense that people don't know who their neighbor is and people don't know who's down the street. So having local business that gets people out on the street and interacting locally, I think, goes a long way towards creating a sense of community, which in the end creates a sense of trust, a sense of shared responsibility within a neighborhood. So there's a certain amount of leakage, I think, that is necessary. No community can be completely self-sufficient for its residents, but if you do have a local bookshop, if you do have a local coffee shop, if you do have local restaurants, being able to support those local restaurants and making conscious decisions to keep your dollars local has a big impact on how people perceive their community, how they treat their community, and also in an extension onto the environment. Obviously, in this day and age, as people are becoming more and more aware about the impact of traveling longer distances to get basic chores done, encouraging people to be able to shorten their commute in order to do basic shopping or to get basic services, I think in the long run will have a big impact on our impact environmentally as well.
Now, one of the things you're doing to encourage local buying is the Boston Community Change Project. Tell me about it.
Sure, I'd love to. Boston Community Change is a pilot program with the Intera Project. That's our partner out in Seattle. Intera was working on this for a couple years before they met us, and really was looking for a way to tap into the power of microtransactions, all those mini transactions that happen on a day-to-day basis, and try to understand how can we direct that transactional flow towards sustainable practice. And sustainable practice in our particular case means directing those dollars towards local community, which we think is a sustainable model, as well as local community groups, which are working very hard to strengthen the community fabric itself, as well as address larger global issues. The Intera Project had a lot of experience and background in the transaction industry, with some experience from founders like D. Hawk, who was the founder of Visa, and they understood the transaction market and the credit card market very, very well. And actually, Visa International, where DHOC had worked, was a large cooperative of banks. And there was a desire to take this idea of a cooperative model and apply it to local community. And that's where Boston Main Streets came in. We met with Intera Project about 2 years ago and started exploring how can we do this at a local level here in Boston's neighborhoods. The Boston Community Change Project links up really three constituents in the community that we think are extremely important. It links up the merchant community, and the merchants are some of the best supporters of local communities. I believe the new statistics say that 45 cents of every dollar spent at a local merchant stays in that community through donations that go back to local community groups, soccer groups, etc. So merchants are a key constituent. All the local community groups themselves, schools and nonprofits are really important constituents in keeping communities strong. And then the residents who live there and work there, and starting to say, how can we link those three different groups in kind of an ecology of support, of sustainable support, where we've launched a program that can continue to grow and provide something for each of those constituents. So Boston Community Change came in wanting to use transactions and provide an ecological model in our neighborhoods. The way the program works now is it actually is a card, a magnetic stripe card that you can get for free, either online at bostoncommunitychange.org, or it's being handed out in person at a lot of events throughout our neighborhoods. The card allows residents anywhere, really, not just in our neighborhoods. We have a lot of cardholders in the suburbs or living in downtown Boston. It allows cardholders to receive rebates, cash rebates, and also to direct dollars back towards any school or any nonprofit that they choose to support through their purchasing, through their transactions when they shop in our local neighborhoods. So this has been something that's received really strong support from the cardholder community because it empowers them to support many of the small local nonprofits that they would like to support through their transactions, as opposed to being locked in and having to support a large national nonprofit through a credit card company. This empowers them to support the local groups without having to purchase a credit card or use a credit card in transactions. The merchants love it because it's a great way for them to actually tap into the power of loyalty marketing. Many of our larger businesses on the periphery already use loyalty marketing very, very effectively to drive business from their most profitable customers, from their best customers, to give something back to those customers who are bringing the most to their shop. And then it taps into the power of cause-based marketing for the merchants as well, the ability to encourage people to buy locally because they can support something they care about, which is becoming more and more popular as a driver for individual purchasing. And then the beneficiaries, the schools and the nonprofits, are all very excited about the program because it gives them an opportunity to potentially drive a new revenue stream for their enterprise. So the nonprofits and beneficiaries are basically driving people to the merchant's doors and receiving something for their efforts in doing so. The merchants are actually providing the rebate to the community groups that are helping keep the social fabric in their neighborhood strong. And the residents are actually starting to develop a habit and an awareness around the importance of supporting local community groups and local community businesses. So we feel like it's providing a win-win-win for each of the players and is positioned really well to have a real impact here in Boston.
So if I go into a boutique, I buy a dress for $100. That's the price tag. What do I get? What does the charity get? And I am assuming, but you may correct me, that the merchant is paying both of those fees, the rebate to me and the donation to the charity, correct?
Correct. Good question. So each of the merchants sets their own rebate level.
Okay.
Which is an important thing. We're not actually forcing a particular rebate onto the merchant. We're saying, well, you decide what's going to be the most profitable rebate model for your business. And then let's imagine that that rebate was 10% off any purchase of $100 or more. And you went into a dress shop and you bought your dress for $100, you would actually show your Boston Community Change card at the time of purchase. They would swipe your card through their credit card machine. Mm-hmm. It's not a payment card. It's more like an identity card. And they would identify that you, Carol, had purchased $100 item, and therefore the back end would identify that you had earned a 10% rebate. The merchant would pay that $10 on the dress, and that would be the end of their payment into the program. For them, that $10 rebate is worth it because they're developing habitual frequency with their customers, and because the merchant is identifying when they're going to give the rebate away. So many of them will only give that rebate away if someone spends a little bit more than their typical average ticket price is in the shop. So the ticket lift that they're getting is offsetting the rebate for the merchant.
And then who pays? Okay, $10 then comes back to me, and who pays the nonprofit?
So what happens is that $10 then gets divided between a cash rebate that goes to you and a portion that goes to the nonprofit.
And who decides that? Who decides that split?
Right. Ultimately, you decided. The way it defaults initially is that 60% of that $10 or $6 goes into a little pool or kitty in your account, and you'd be able to cash in and have that cash sent to you at a later date. And another 20% goes to support the local community, including the Main Streets program and the nonprofit that you've chosen, which could be any 501c3 who's registered with the IRS or any school that's registered with the Department of Education. So that's 80%. And then the other 20% is used to support and sustain the program. So it's sort of like administrative fees.
Gotcha. And how many cardholders do you have?
Right. I'll answer that question just when I finish. One last piece of the last question, because the 60% that's accumulated as a cash rebate for you can actually be donated completely to the nonprofit as well. So you can then say, I'm not interested in receiving cash. I'd rather just have the full 60% of my cash as well as the 20% go to nonprofit causes. So you can effectively donate 80% of it. As far as cardholders now in the district, we have a little over 4,000 cardholders, and we have about 160 businesses to date.
And you launched the program when?
We launched the program about a year ago. I believe last November we had sort of a soft launch, and we really got going in January of 2007. So we've been building up for about a year. Kind of across the city here.
And when you talked originally to Intera about this program, what were your expectations in year one?
Well, it's a great question. It was such a it was such a new concept that I don't think we had any real good sense of where we'd like to be. I can tell you where we'd like to be by the end of this year. I think, you know, we feel for the program to be sustainable, we need probably about 25,000 cardholders here in Boston, and we'd like to see about 1,500 businesses across our neighborhoods. So we have a long ways to go, and we know that. We're looking for kind of really innovative ways to get the cardholders into the market and to encourage not just people having cards, but also the increased usage of cards in our neighborhoods.
Right.
And some of those things go hand in hand. So we can get cards into people's hands, but without a strong business base to support those cardholders, many of them would just get frustrated. So we're trying to build the two in parallel here in the city. We're hoping, we're growing at about 100 to 150 cards a week right now. These are people signing up for cards online or getting cards at various events. And we're looking for really creative partnerships with larger nonprofits to help us promote the program, as well as partnerships with city institutions like the library to really get the word out there. It's the biggest challenge for us is an awareness challenge. Once people learn about the program, they're thrilled to sign up. We're sharpening our teeth as promoters as far as getting the word out and really creating some excitement and buzz around what the program can do here in Boston.
Brian Goodman is business manager at Boston Main Streets. You're listening to Smart City. This week's City Views commentator Walker Smith talks about birthdays
but preferably not his own.
I've always avoided birthdays. In fact, it's fair to say that I just flat out hate them. My own birthdays, that is. I'm happy to join in and celebrate someone else's birthday, just not my own. Needless to say, this drives my family and friends crazy. Celebrating anniversaries is a part of human nature. We mark passages with rituals and ceremonies, and that, I suppose, is exactly why I avoid birthdays. Getting older is not something I want to observe or commemorate. Historians have found evidence of birthday celebrations dating back thousands of years. In many ancient pagan cultures, major life changes like turning a year older were thought to put a person at greater risk from evil spirits. So birthdays were observed with fun and good cheer to fend off the evil spirits lurking about. People were surrounded and protected by good wishes and happy thoughts. These early birthday celebrations weren't about the person with the birthday so much as they were about the community coming together to embrace and look after a member of that community. While the individual was the focus of everyone's efforts, the community was the force at work. In coming together, the community asserted its power and authority in order to vanquish threats to its collective strength and integrity. The connection of the individual to the community at large was reinforced and validated. Or to put it another way, birthday celebrations were more for the guest than for the guest of honor. Getting older is not what birthdays should celebrate, but aging gets most of the attention nowadays, which is why I avoid birthdays. A 2002 survey of 50 to 80-year-olds conducted at the University of Sussex in England found that few liked the fact that birthdays signify getting older, and that many disliked the increasing commercialization of birthday celebrations. But everyone thought that birthdays should be remembered because they are occasions on which the ties of family and friendship can be commemorated and reasserted. In other words, birthdays are for everyone else. And this, of course, is what makes my family and friends crazy about my avoidance of birthdays. My birthdays aren't about me. They're about the other people in my life and their chance to come together in a celebration of our ties and connections. As my youngest sister admonished me on my last birthday, the dreaded 5-0, the day of my birth is one of the most important days in my mother's life. My mother doesn't want to toast the fact that I'm getting old. She wants to remember that happy day in the life of our family. My sister is right, of course. Avoiding my birthdays is not simply a personal choice because my birthdays are for other people, too. It's a family celebration, not a selfish occasion. I guess you have to get older even to see this truth. Now I just need to get old enough to accept it with grace and thanks. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. His latest book is Generation Ageless. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.